Finally get to know the FRW spacetime well. So basically we want to do three things. First of all, we want to understand the kinematics. So that's basically geodesics, and in particular how massive and massless particles behave when they live in an expanding universe, and then also the horizon structure of these spacetimes, and then the dynamics. Okay, and then you will explore each of these things a little bit more in the tutorial this afternoon. So basically, solving the two equations, Friedmann plus continuity, the two main equations that you're deriving in problem two of the homework this week. And then, you know, as we go along, we're gradually meeting some of the basic puzzles about the universe that any theory of the universe should attempt to explain. So here we'll meet the horizon puzzle. And here we will meet the flatness puzzle. Okay, so maybe before diving in, should I save the joke until some later point in the lecture when you guys are more beaten down and drooling on your paper? And I will save it for a little bit later. None of you seem to be drooling just yet. So let's start with how do geodesics behave in FRW? Okay, so this is, again, I want to boil this down to one key point you should remember forever, which is that the essential answer is that whether you're a massive particle or a massless particle, the magnitude of your spatial momentum, magnitude of your three momentum, decays as 1 over the scale factor. So as the universe expands and the scale factor A grows, remember A is a function of time, your momentum will correspondingly decrease proportional to 1 over A. Okay, so let's just derive that. So the starting point, remember, is the geodesic equation. Remember the first form that we wrote the geodesic equation in, we said, well, if you have a curve, if a particle moves along some curve, x mu of tau, yeah? Sorry, thank you. If a particle moves along some curve, x mu of tau, with tangent vector u mu, which is dx mu d tau, then a geodesic parallel transports its own tangent vector. It's a curve that has that property. So the directional derivative, in other words, the directional derivative along the curve of the tangent vector to the curve, vanishes. Okay, now we want to ask a question about momenta here, so we're going to make use of the fact that in general relativity, the momentum of a particle is related to its four-velocity u by just a proportionality factor of the mass. So the four-momentum, so in other words, this is the four-vector that has as its components the energy of the particle and the three-momentum of the particle. That's just related to the four-velocity by a proportionality factor, which is the mass of the particle. Okay, so I'll just multiply by mass squared here and rewrite this geodesic equation as p nu. Okay, and then it's convenient to just switch parameters. So this is This is m dx mu d tau, and it's just convenient. It'll be convenient when handling the massless case to have merged these two guys into a single parameter lambda that doesn't behave pathologically in the m goes to zero limit. Okay, so in other words, lambda is just t tau over m. Okay, so let's now expand this out in an FRW spacetime. Okay, so expanding out this covariant derivative, it becomes d mu p nu plus gamma mu nu alpha p alpha. equals zero. Okay, but now, so this guy says, let's look at this first term. The first term says dx mu d lambda times partial p nu partial x nu. Well, by the chain rule, x mu. So by the chain rule, this term is nothing but dp nu d lambda. Okay? And then the second term here, well, the second term is what it is. So in other words, the equation becomes, okay, let me just rename some of the indices to make it look a little bit nicer. dp mu d lambda plus gamma alpha beta mu p alpha p beta is equal to zero. Okay, so let's look at the mu equals zero component of this equation. So that's four equations. I want to look at the mu equals zero component. So now, one of the things you derive on the homework this week is that, we're going to need the gamma, zero, alpha, beta, Christoffel symbols. And one of the things you derive is that gamma, zero, zero vanishes, and gamma, zero, zero, I, and gamma, zero, I, zero, because it's symmetric in these two lower indices. These guys are both zero. The only thing that is not zero here is gamma, zero, ij, and that is just equal to the Hubble expansion rate, h, times the 3 metric, ij. And again, if you haven't had a chance to look closely at the homework yet, I'm using this notation where I use mu, I use Greek indices to run from 0 to 3, spacetime indices, whereas I and j just run from 1 to 3. Those are just spatial indices. Okay, so this is just the spatial part of the metric. Okay, so if I just use these things and plug in for mu equals zero, this becomes dp zero d lambda plus what I'll call capital P, H. H times capital P squared, where capital P squared is just defined to be the magnitude of the spatial 3 momentum. In other words, it's just defined to be the spatial part of the metric contracted with the spatial part of the moment of the 4 momentum. Okay, is that clear? And this is equal to 0. Okay, and now to put this in the form that we want, let me just use another relation, which again just follows from this definition relating the mass and the momentum, the mass and the 4 velocity and the momentum. That relation is that the mass squared of the particle, which is conserved, that's a conserved quantity carried by the particle, is equal to p0 squared minus capital P squared. In other words, it's just equal to g mu nu contracted with p mu p nu, And if you just plug that in, and use the fact that for the FRW metric, G00 is minus 1, G0i is 0, and Gij is what it is. It's non-zero, but Gij appears in the definition of capital P squared here. So we have m squared is equal to that. Let me just take the differential of that equation. So the differential of this side gives 0. The differential of this side gives 2p0 dp0 minus 2 capital P d capital P. And so, yeah? Yep.
Okay.
Yes. Gij just denotes the full spatial part of the metric. So in other words, P0 dp0 is equal to capital P d capital P. Let me use that to eliminate dp0 here. Okay, so I'll rewrite dp0 as capital P d capital P over p0. I'll plug that into this equation to get let's see. If I don't screw things up. No, that's not what I mean to say. dp0 is pdp. Over p0 d lambda. Did I do that right? Plus h p squared is equal to 0. Okay, but now, this should be p0. So now I'll just, first of all, let me divide by p squared on both sides here. So I'll kill that p squared. I'll move this p to the denominator. And then here, p0 d lambda, well, p0 is just dx0 d lambda. In other words, dt d lambda. So dt d lambda times d lambda is just dt. So this whole thing is just equal to dt. Whereas I remind you that h, we learned last time that the definition of h, the Hubble parameter here, is a dot over a. Okay, so just putting these things together, this equation now says 1 over p dp dt plus 1 over a dA dt is equal to 0. Okay, so in other words, let me just rewrite this as equals minus 1 over a dA dt, and then I'll erase the dt's on both sides. Now, if I just integrate this equation on both sides, this is log of p on this side is equal to minus log of a on this side plus an arbitrary constant. If I just exponentiate both sides now, that says that p is proportional to 1 over a. Okay, so this is the result that I say you should remember for the rest of your life. It encapsulates in a simple equation a lot of the key physics of how massive and massless particles behave. So let's just talk a little bit about that. So let's first see what this equation says about massive particles. Okay, so for massive particles, you know, the momentum of a particle is its mass times its velocity times its gamma factor. Okay, so in the non-relativistic limit, this is not going to be crucially important for us. So in the non-relativistic limit, it becomes approximately, you know, gamma becomes approximately 1. Gamma is this, you guys know what gamma is? Gamma is this guy. This factor that always appears in special relativity. So anyway, so in the limit where v is not too large, this is approximately just mv. So and m is constant. So this is really saying, in the non-relativistic limit, this is really saying that the velocity of a massive particle relative to the co-moving spatial coordinates is going to zero. Okay? Because remember, there when we say when we're evaluating this p was dx mu d lambda, and the velocity is dx mu dt. So the spatial part of this is the change in the co-moving spatial coordinate x with respect to lambda or t. Okay, so physically, what is this saying? So again, if we just look at the closed universe, the universe with the FRW universe with k is equal to plus 1, because it's easiest to draw on the blackboard. And again, the co-moving coordinates we should think of as we take a marker and we draw dots on the sphere, and those dots just stay there. Those are fixed spatial coordinates. And then the radius of this sphere is a of t. The universe is confined to the surface of the sphere. I'm just drawing it in some fictitious embedding space. But so the radius of the sphere in this flat embedding space is a of t. The co-moving coordinates are just dots that I've drawn on the sphere, on this balloon if you want. And now the expansion of the universe just corresponds to me blowing up the balloon. And what this says is that, okay, so now suppose I take a massive particle that's not a co-moving observer. So I start it at some time shooting in this direction. So it's traveling in this direction along the balloon with, you know, at 1,000 kilometers per second, some pretty fast velocity by terrestrial standards. Then as the universe expands, he'll be moving along the balloon. And sometime later, maybe the balloon has grown in radius by a factor of 2. Okay, so at that time, this rocket, or this not rocket, this because it's not, it's just freely flying. It's not, rocket was the wrong word. It's not like firing a rocket. It's just moving along a geodesic. So this rock, okay, so I threw some rock at 1,000 kilometers per second. It went shooting off across the universe. When it left my house, I was like, whoa! I really fired that thing fast, you know. That was an attempt at dramatization of the equations. When it gets over to here, the universe has grown by a factor of 2. Some other person like me sees the rock go flying by, but now it's only flying at 500 kilometers per second. And then later, the universe has grown by a factor of 10. The rock has made it over here. It passes the co-moving observer, the little mark on the balloon here. And this person says, oh, that's only moving at 100 kilometers a second. Okay? So in other words, the expansion of the expansion of the universe, just the fact that as this rock is trying to get to these subsequent observers, the balloon is expanding, and so the observers are getting further away from the rock. They effectively have a velocity away from the rock due to the expansion of the universe, means that the rock overtakes each subsequent co-moving observer with a slower and slower speed. Okay, and so this is, and eventually it basically comes to rest. Okay, so you can send a massive particle initially very fast, but the universe will eventually slow it down. The expansion of the universe is effectively like some sort of molasses acting on this thing. And so that often goes under the name Hubble drag. Or Hubble friction. And so, you know, you do not expect if you see some object, some massive object in the universe today that you know formed a long time ago, and you have some reasonable reason to know that it didn't form with some stupendously relativistic velocity, then today, long after it formed, you expect it to be moving, to be almost at rest with respect to the Hubble expansion. You expect it to be almost a co-moving observer. Okay, so and that is what you observe, that galaxies and clusters in the universe today, the actual physical objects that are essentially the massive particles living on the cosmological background, they are almost at rest with respect to the cosmological expansion. They are almost, so our Milky Way galaxy is almost a co-moving observer in the Friedman-Robertson-Walker space-time. The small velocity that it has, so the small velocity that an object has with respect to the co-moving observer that it is passing at that moment is called its peculiar velocity. Okay, and so for what it's worth, most of the objects in the universe today happen to have peculiar velocities that are about, you know, kind of 100 kilometers per second, hundreds of kilometers per second, so something like 10 to the minus 3 of the speed of light. Okay, so they're moving very non-relativistically, not stupendously non-relativistically. They have a few hundred kilometers per second velocity. Okay, so that's the interpretation for massive particles. Now let's talk about massless particles. So for massless particles, again, the spatial part of the momentum fades as 1 over a. But now the spatial part of the momentum for a massless particle is equal to its energy. Right, again, this is just a massless particle moves along a trajectory with a light-like trajectory, a ds squared, a trajectory that everywhere has ds squared is equal to 0. So, in other words, when you take the tangent to this curve, and contract it with g mu nu, that's equal to 0. In other words, p mu, g mu nu is equal to 0. Or in other words, e squared minus what we were calling capital P squared is equal to 0. And we know from quantum mechanics that the energy of a photon is h bar Planck's constant times omega, the angular frequency of the photon. Okay, so what this is really saying is that as the universe, for a photon never slows down. You know, it always moves past, every time it passes a co-moving observer, the co-moving observer says, you know, so if we draw the same picture here, and we have our co-moving observers drawn on the sphere, and now at some time we fire a photon in this direction, a massless particle. It passes these various co-moving observers along the way. Every time it passes a co-moving observer, the co-moving observer, of course, says this photon is moving at the speed of light. That's one of the basic inputs in relativity. But if I release it with some particular frequency omega, or in other words, some wavelength, lambda is equal to 2 pi over omega, then by the time it passes this co-moving observer, if the universe between here and here, if the radius is expanded by a factor of 2, then when it passes this co-moving observer, its frequency will have gone down by a factor of 2. Okay, it's relative to its original frequency, and its wavelength will have increased by a factor of 2 relative to its original wavelength. Okay, so in other words, the photon, the massless particles get stretched in proportion to the stretching of the universe. Okay, and this phenomenon was already observed by Hubble in the 1920s before the relativistic understanding of what was going on was obtained. It was one of the crucial observational inputs. He looked out, so he, you know, Hubble sits on the Earth, he looks out with his telescope, And he measures the spectra coming from different galaxies. And what he finds is that when he looks at distant galaxies, that that he sees spectra that look just like the spectra that he sees on Earth. So, you know, they have lines that clearly correspond to certain absorption and emission lines of various well-known atoms like hydrogen. But the lines are all at lower frequencies than what you see in a Earth laboratory, okay? And in particular, he has another way of measuring the distances to these galaxies, and what he finds is that the galaxies that are further away have their spectral lines redshifted, in other words, lowered by a larger factor. Okay, so this galaxy, the observed spectral lines are a little bit redder than what you see on Earth. This galaxy, they're a lot redder. Even further galaxies are even redder. And the interpretation is that the geometrical interpretation here is that this galaxy is relatively nearby to us. So when it emitted its photons to us, the spectral lines were at exactly the frequencies that we observe on Earth. But as those photons traveled from here to here, the universe expanded a little bit, and the photons, the wavelength of the photons, expanded with them. And so they've been redshifted a little bit. They've been shifted to lower frequencies a little bit. These guys, since they're further away, they emitted their photons earlier. They emitted them at exactly the frequencies that we observe in the lab on Earth. But during their subsequent flight, again, the universe expanded. And since they were further away, they were emitted further in the past. So the universe has had more time to expand during the time of flight. And so a bigger redshift accrued. Okay, there's another, you know, the way Hubble, who came along pre-relativity, would have explained the same phenomenon. You know, there's another equivalent explanation, which is how Hubble would have originally stated it. You know, he didn't have this notion that the universe was somehow a geometrical manifold that was expanding with time. He just said this is the Doppler effect. For some reason, it's an empirical fact that comes out of my observations, that galaxies that are closer to me, that basically all the galaxies I see in the sky are all moving away from the Earth, and the ones that are closer are moving away slowly, and the ones that are further are moving away quickly. And the reason that I see their photons shifted to the red, lengthened, relative to the lab frame on Earth, is just the Doppler effect, the ordinary Doppler effect, that objects moving away from me, I see their emitted signals at an effectively lower frequency. So that's really the same effect, because, you know, if you look at this picture, the physical distance, if at some moment in time the distance on the sphere is between these two points is r0, then as a function of time, as the universe grows, that the physical distance will grow in proportion to a. And so what the velocity that I will perceive of this galaxy relative to me is the time derivative of its distance away from me. And everything here is a constant except for a. So that'll be proportional to, well, that'll just be equal to a dot over a0 r0. So in other words, okay, a dot is the same at a given time, but guys that are further away from me will have a bigger r0. They will appear to be proportionally moving away from me faster. Okay, is that clear? So there are these two interpretations. They're both really the same thing. Certainly at short distances, they're the same thing. If you're following closely, you may observe that I glossed over a slight subtlety there, I glossed over it on purpose, so I'm not gonna. That's somehow when I say that, I've trapped myself into unglossing over it. But really, I would like to gloss over it. Okay, so I think that's everything to say about geodesics, about the kinematics of massive and massless particles. So now let's talk about horizons. So, you know, you're all familiar with the fact, yep.
How do we commence with the computation of the potential?
So, so if you think of matter as like test particles moving on a background spacetime, then the energy will, their energy will only be conserved. Their energy is not conserved because they're, you know, conservation of energy is a property of time translation invariance. Whereas these guys are living on a background, the world they live in is not invariant under time translation. It's changing. It's expanding as a function of time. So it's sucking energy out of the individual particles. If you look at the whole system, gravity plus matter, if you take somehow the collective energy of the whole thing, then there is a sense in which the energy is conserved and strictly zero, actually. The Hamiltonian, basically, is constrained to be strictly zero at all times because the whole Lagrangian has no explicit time dependence. But if you separate the matter and the gravity, and you just look at the energy of the matter part by itself, then if the gravitational background, if the metric that it's living on is changing with time, is not time translation invariant, then the matter will not exhibit conservation of energy. So horizons. You know, so you're all familiar. Well, let me just plunge in. It's best to just look at a simple example. Let's focus on the case where the universe is spatially flat, k equals zero. Okay, so it's not closed up into a sphere. It's not spatially a hyperboloid. Let's also take the case that let's just assume that it is, in fact, forget about this guy. Simpler way to say this. Let's just assume that the universe is expanding as a power of t. Okay, let's just assume that I've put in whatever matter content is necessary to make the universe expand like that. What is life like for an observer in this universe? Well, so it's convenient. It's going to be easier to answer this question. We want to understand basically whether an observer in this universe can receive signals from everywhere. So some observer, that's their world line. They're living in this expanding universe that's expanding according to this power law, expansion law. And we want to know, you know, at a given time, can they receive signals from everywhere in the manifold, from everywhere in the space-time, or is there only some finite swath of the universe that they can receive signals from? And also, can they send signals to everywhere in the universe, or is there only some finite swath of the universe that they can send signals to? In Minkowski space, for reference, you know, at any time, I can send out light signals, and if I wait long enough, those will reach spatial observers who are arbitrarily far away from me in space. And similarly, at any given time, I can receive signals from observers who are arbitrarily far away from me, as long as they sent them to me sufficiently far in the past. Okay, but that won't be the case in these FRW universes. So to see it, it's better to switch to this conformal time coordinate. Remember that last time we saw that there are sort of two standard radial coordinates. There's the sort of, we started by introducing quasi-Cartesian, by deriving the metric in quasi-Cartesian coordinates, x1, x2, x3. And then there was, it's conventional to switch to spherical coordinates where these guys are just given by r times sine theta, cosine phi, sine theta, sine phi, and cosine theta. So that's one notion of radius, and then there's this other notion of radius that we that's also convenient in many contexts, which was related by this equation S sub chi. So there's these two different radii that are conventional that you'll meet again in the tutorial this afternoon, and then there are two different times that are conventional. So we start off by writing the metric as minus dt squared plus a squared of t times some spatial part, but then it's often convenient to replace dt here by a coordinate eta defined by the relation dt is equal to a of eta d eta, because then when we do that, we get an a squared here and an a squared here. We can pull the a squared out front, and now the metric looks like minus d eta squared plus this same thing over here. Okay, so if we want to convert this guy into conformal time, so by this relation, the conformal time is related to the proper time by dt over a of t. Okay, so this, you know, so when we integrate this, what's going to happen? This is a 1 power of t, p powers of t here. So eta will be proportional, in this case, to t to the 1 minus p. So if we rewrite a in terms of eta, it will look like eta over eta naught to the t is proportional to eta, maybe, so t is proportional to eta to the 1 over t, so t according to this will be proportional to eta to the 1 over 1 minus p, and so when we use that to remove t here, we'll find that the scale factor is proportional to eta to the power p over 1 minus p. Okay, but you know, here let's focus on the case where this is an expanding universe with t running from 0 to infinity and p positive. Okay, so this universe had better be expanding as well. It's just describing the same universe but in different coordinates. So, but you see that this exponent is positive when 0 is less than p is less than 1. It breaks up into two regimes. When 0 is less than p is less than 1, the exponent is positive. And when 1 is less than p, and p is greater than 1, the exponent is negative. So in this case, when p is positive, in order to describe the same universe, which expands from 0 size to infinite size as from the beginning of time to the end of time, we should also have eta run from 0 to infinity here. But here, where the exponent is negative, it had better be the case, and this is true if you just go through the integration and if you just follow it through, it had better be the case that when we do that integral and change coordinates from here to here, that what we find is that eta, since the exponent is negative, if we want this to be an expanding universe, that won't happen if we let eta run, if eta runs from 0 to infinity. Eta had better run from minus infinity to 0. So So with those basic, so now that we've written this thing in terms of eta, let's imagine our observer. Okay, let's first imagine that at some moment they send out a photon, and we want to ask, how far away does the photon get? Well, not only will we work in not so we've already said that to answer the question, we want to choose between the coordinates t and eta, the coordinate eta. Now, we also have a choice between r and chi for our radial coordinate, and it's convenient to take chi to be. It's convenient to choose chi because I remind you that in chi coordinates, this box that I've omitted here, it looks like d chi squared plus an angular part. Okay. So, but let's just imagine that this let's imagine for simplicity that the observer sends out the photon in the purely radial direction. So it doesn't. He's sitting right at the origin. He fires a photon out in the radial in the chi direction. So it's not changing its angle at all. So this part of the metric doesn't matter anyway. Okay. So again, and this is what appears in this box up here. So the metric. For our purposes, neglecting the angular part, is a squared of eta minus d eta squared plus d chi squared. And a photon moves along a trajectory where ds squared is equal to 0. It moves along a light-like direction. So in other words, it moves along a trajectory with d eta is equal to plus or minus d chi. And in particular, If we're interested in an observer who emits a photon, so from the origin, so as time goes forward, as eta goes forward, the radial coordinate of the photon gets bigger. We want the plus sign here, and so we integrate, and we find that he emits it from the origin at some time eta star, and at a later time, its radial coordinate away from him. Is just eta minus eta star. But now you see here that that in one case, in the case where p is between 0 and 1, eta runs up to positive infinity. And so as the photon, if I wait an arbitrarily long time, the photon reaches arbitrarily large chi. It can cross the entire space-time. It can reach an arbitrarily distant co-moving observer. So that's the case where p is equal. That's the case where p is between 0 and 1. So we say this guy has no future horizon. If I send a photon to the future. It can get arbitrarily far away from me. But in the other case, where p is greater than 1, here, eta only runs up to a finite time in the future. So I emitted the photon at some particular time, some negative value of eta. And then I let eta go as far as it can go. It can only get up to 0. It can only get up to some finite value. And so chi maxes out at some finite value. That maximal value of chi, namely 0 minus eta star, the negative thing that I started with, that's the coordinate of the furthest co-moving observer that I can ever send a signal to in that universe. Okay, so this guy does have a future horizon. And if you look back at our original expression for A, where a is proportional to t to the p, this difference between p being less than 1 or greater than 1 precisely corresponds to whether a double dot, the second time derivative, in other words, d squared a dt squared, whether that's negative. So if the in this first case, when p is less than 1, the universe is expanding but decelerating. In the second case, the universe is expanding but accelerating. A double dot is greater than 0. Okay? So that's a basic feature. This toy model illustrates it, but it's a rule of thumb to keep in mind. In an accelerating universe, there is a future horizon. An observer sends out a photon, but there's some furthest co-moving observer that photon will ever reach, and then there are other co-moving observers who are even further away that will never get a signal from him. Okay, and so when the universe is decelerating, there's no such future horizon. Okay, so this sort of future horizon, this is like being inside a black hole, right? The observer inside the horizon. This is how the horizon appears to an observer inside the black hole. They want to send a signal out, but there's some surface that the signal will just never be able to cross. It'll never be able to get out of the black hole and reach an observer outside. Okay, if you just go through the exact same analysis, but for think about the observer receiving the photon. So in other words, now the photon is coming in. So now as time goes forward, the photon is coming toward the observer at the origin. So we want the minus sign here. As eta goes forward, chi gets smaller, the radial coordinate gets smaller. So now we integrate that equation and we get the it just looks, there's an overall minus sign here. And so now we're asking, as we look to the past, how far away, as I take eta further and further back, as far back as it can go, what's the furthest co-moving observer, chi, I can reach? So now that the story is flipped. Now, in the p less than 1 case, the decelerating case, eta only goes back to a finite time. In the accelerating case, eta goes back to minus infinity. So the situation is reversed, that in the accelerating case, in the decelerating case, there is no future horizon, but there is past horizon. And in the accelerating case, there is a future horizon, but there is no past horizon. Okay? And so, is that clear? So this is like the horizon. So again, is it physically clear in a time evolving space-time, in a cosmological space-time, it's important to distinguish between future horizons and past horizons. So again, this is a future horizon means there are some co-moving observers I'll never be able to get a signal to. Past horizon means there are some co-moving observers who will never be able to reach me with their signal, no matter how early on in the evolution of the universe they sent it. So this is like the black hole horizon. This is analogous to the black hole horizon as seen from the inside. This is analogous to the black hole horizon as seen from the outside, right? Because the outside observer can never receive a signal from observers inside the black hole. Yeah?
On the picture, for a person sending out a light source, how would we see, how would you draw the future horizon?
Okay, the first thing I should say is that there's a confusing subtlety here, which is that I was imagining that chi runs from 0 to infinity. Actually, in a closed universe, chi only runs from 0 to pi. Nevertheless, it turns out the same story is true. There is a future horizon for when the space-time is accelerating. What's happening here is at some moment in time, this observer, let's say the balloon is accelerating. It's not only growing, but its expansion is speeding up. So this guy at some time sends out a photon. And even though as it passes every co-moving observer, that co-moving observer always says that photon is moving at the speed of light. Nevertheless, it's taking longer and longer to reach every subsequent, if I make sort of evenly spaced tick marks here, it's taking longer and longer to reach each subsequent co-moving observer because it passes this co-moving observer at the speed of light, but meanwhile, the balloon is expanding. So in physical size, and if I'm blowing up the balloon, this guy is moving, getting further away. And so eventually this photon catches up with this guy, and this guy says, you know, oh, it's moving at the speed of light. But meanwhile, if you ask how long does it take to get to the next tick mark, it's longer. And the point is that the threshold between when the sum diverges at some point in the case where in terms of physical time, in the case where the balloon is accelerating, in terms of physical time, by the time t gets to infinity, you know, the flash of light that you've sent out from here has only made it to this distance on the balloon. Now keep in mind that is an infinite physical distance. In the same time, the balloon has grown to an infinite size. So the light has traveled an infinite physical distance. But in terms of what angle of the balloon has it managed to cover, it's only some finite angle. So there's the whole rest of the balloon worth of co-moving observers who will just never receive the signal.
No matter how small the
In the closed case, in the flat case, yes. In the closed case, I'd have to think about it. I'm a little hesitant to say that. It's an academic point in our actual universe because our actual universe is so close to flat that which is why I don't have the answer off the top of my head. But I'm sorry. So the bottom line is there's only a finite tie available. So if the signal gets sent sufficiently early and the acceleration is sufficiently slow, then indeed the signal will get all the way around the balloon. So no, actually. It has to be a sufficiently, you know, it has to be sent it has to be the appropriate combination of what time it's sent and how fast the universe is accelerating in the closed case. That's all I think I wanted to I wanted to say one other important thing about that. We can now say one of the main observational puzzles about the universe that we live in, which is that, okay, the universe that we live in, we see that today it contains ordinary non-relativistic matter, like stars and galaxies and you and me, okay? And it contains some relativistic matter, massless particles, photons. Radiation. Now, we will see that both of these, if this is all the universe contains, if the universe is dominated by these normal types of matter, and there's very good evidence that the universe was dominated by this type of matter from roughly 1 second after the Big Bang until close to the present epoch. Okay, it turns out more recently it appears that there has been something that's been causing the acceleration of the universe and that commonly is referred to as dark energy, even though we don't really know what it is. But anyway, that's a recent phenomenon. So for most of the expansion of the universe, since the time that the light elements in the periodic table were formed until the present, the universe has been dominated by this normal matter, in which, and during that time, it has been decelerating. So So a decelerating universe, we just saw, has a past horizon. And the problem is that, you can sketch it like this, that if we sort of imagine an eta, a space-time diagram with eta as the time coordinate and chi as the space coordinate. This is us here. We look back with our telescopes. We receive photons from all directions. In particular, if we look up with microwave photons, if we look up with microwave telescopes, we see what are today microwave photons. We see that the universe, the sky is full of a bath of microwave photons. And as we'll discuss later, we know where these guys are coming from. They are coming from a moment. They were released at a moment about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, when suddenly all of the protons and electrons in the universe combined to make neutral hydrogen atoms. Okay, suddenly that happened, and the universe was full of photons that no longer had any charged particles to run into, and so they began just streaming across the universe, and some of them reach our telescopes today. Okay, and the problem is that if you ask, if the universe was really just full of matter and radiation, the ordinary matter and radiation that we see, the actual matter that we have evidence for, and you extrapolate back how far in the past was the Big Bang here, it was like here, okay? The problem is that we look out in one direction on the sky, we observe the properties of the cosmic microwave background. It has some frequency spectrum, for example. We look out in the other direction, the diametrically opposite direction on the sky with our telescope, and we observe the photons that are coming from over here, and they look exactly the same. They have exactly the same spectrum to better than a part in one to better than one part in 100,000. Okay, so they're. These two spots on the sky, diametrically opposite sides of the sky, are virtually identical. But if you look at their past, they each have, just like we have a past horizon, if the universe is decelerating, we can't see beyond this light cone. They each have a past horizon as well. They can't see beyond their own smaller light cones, past light cones. And in particular, their past light cones have no overlap. So how did they manage to coordinate? How did they manage to get themselves into apparently thermal equilibrium with one another? These two guys are both, they're perfectly, what they emit to us is a perfectly thermal spectrum of radiation corresponding to a gas in equilibrium. And so they're both somehow in thermal equilibrium at exactly the same temperature, even though apparently they didn't have time to make causal contact with one another prior to sending those, between the Big Bang and the time that they sent those signals to us. So that's the so-called horizon puzzle. About the universe today. I will try to not make a habit of running over. Okay, so the third part of the tutorial was about solving the continuity. The third part of the lecture was going to be a sketch of how to solve the continuity and Friedman equations. But then we were going to do that in more detail in the tutorial. So I think it'll just be fine. We'll just make the tutorial a little bit more wordy to make sure it's clear how to solve them. And you guys will just explore that there. And then tomorrow we'll be able to get on to statistical mechanics in the Friedman-Robertson-Walker space-time, which will let us understand the simple picture of the cosmic microwave background and Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the two sort of basic bits of evidence that basic observational probes of the early universe and basic bits of evidence that we know what we're talking about in describing the early universe as an expanding effort of the universe. Okay.